Welcome. It's lovely to welcome all of you here, some of you to Augustana, perhaps some of you for the first time, to Catholic High School from St. Albert has come. I'm delighted that the Vatican astronomer has given you the opportunity to escape and escape the universe of your normal dwelling and come here and be with us. It's lovely to see you. The number of young people who are here, welcome. It's lovely to have you join us. Why science and faith matter to each other. I'm delighted to welcome Father Jose Funes here with us today. This is part of the Festival of Ideas that the University of Alberta does annually, perhaps, and certainly for this year as well. And working with them a little bit, we were able to arrange for Father Funes to come as well as for Professor Cummins, who is here. Right there, who's an astrophysicist, and they will be speaking together tonight at the TELUS World of Science at 8 p.m. Tonight they'll be speaking about Are We Alone in the Universe? And exploring that theme. Today, this morning, we have the pleasure of listening to Father Funes speak about why science and faith matter to each other. Father Funes is primarily interested in the galaxies, the near galaxies, and his research work has focused on that. But the whole question of is there life in the enormous number of galaxies that exist has become one that the Vatican has also gathered people together to think about a little bit. I, of course, have the gall to say that Father Funes sits in Galileo's chair, and I hope he's not going to disabuse you of that, because I think it's a great line, and I would like it to be preserved. He is the director of the Vatican Observatory in Rome, which is also responsible for the Vatican Advanced Technology Telescope, which is on Mount Graham in Arizona. So he splits his time between Arizona and the Vatican. He has said in a number of places that his work as a scientist helps him be a person of faith as well. And perhaps we will hear a little bit about that today. Father Funes is a Jesuit, and we all, of course, here at in Camrose, we have a favorite Jesuit here in Camrose who is here among us, but I won't introduce you to him. We have a relationship to the Jesuit order here. The Jesuits have had a long interest in science and have been important to that part of the Roman Catholic Church. So I'm delighted he's here with us and bringing together in the discussion today both the enormous gifts of science, which captured his imagination when he was young, continued through his doctorate at the University of Padua, and also as a priest, someone who, on behalf of the Roman Catholic Church, seeks to pull forth life in all places and all times. So welcome. Thank you for coming.
First, I would like to thank the organizers of the Festival of Ideas for inviting me here at the University of Alberta. I would like to thank Professor Goa because of his kind introduction, and he was very kind in driving us, Professor Cummins and myself, from Edmonton this morning. Thank you. And we had a nice chat in the car. As you are already aware, I'm from Argentina, from my accent. And when I used to teach at the University of Arizona a class of astronomy to students with a non-science major, the first thing I used to tell them is the following. The biggest challenge you have to face in my class is not math nor physics, it's my accent. So I repeat the same to you. I'm sorry, if you don't understand my English, I will try to explain in a better way. If you don't understand my science, maybe I'm going to ask Dr. Cummings to answer that question. If you don't understand my theology, please don't call Rome. Okay. Okay. I'm very glad also to see you here, because when I was your age, when I was 12 or 13, about 13, I decided to become an astronomer. And when I was 6 was when the man arrived to the moon for the first time. And I think that was the first moment I realized that my vocation was to be an astronomer. Okay, so I'm very glad to see you here. So, to talk about science and faith, I use images, because images many times tell more than words. Here, you know, of course, this guy is Albert. I don't need to introduce him, Albert Einstein, but maybe you don't know Georges Lemaître. He was a priest, but he was also an important cosmologist who prepared the way for the Big Bang model. So he was an important cosmologist of the time. So this is the outline of my talk. I would like to say a bit about the cultural context, how science and faith do matter to each other, some historical examples. I propose a starting point for discussing the relationship between science and faith. So this is the outline of my talk. Some caveats for interdisciplinary dialogue, not only for science and theology, but also for other sciences or disciplines. I should be aware of the different backgrounds. This talk, given in Italy, or in Argentina, or in the United States, or here in Canada, would be different, because the participants of the dialogue are different. You are different. You come from a different cultural and religious background. So I'm aware that English is not my mother tongue, so you can say things in a not the way you would like it. You can be more aggressive or less aggressive than you want. So forgive me for that. Also, we need to be aware that there are different methods and languages in science and theology. It's not the same. And the dialogue requires a certain knowledge of both sides, science and theology or religion. Thank you. You saved 2 seconds. So one thing about the cultural context. You know that a few weeks ago there was this book by Stephen Hawking, The Grand Design. I have to confess that I haven't read the book, but many journalists asked me, what do you think about it? So I went to Google when I was a few days ago, and I put these words, God, Stephen, and Hawking, in news, and there were about 61 links, news. So this just to say that this topic is important for the general public. It is in the media. I'm not going to comment on his book because I have not read the book. Can we move to the following? I'm sorry if there is a journal, Rebecca, maybe.
No.
I want to say something about the media. And again, I'm coming from Italy. Maybe Canada is a different reality, but I think the media plays an important role in this discussion. It's important to communicate, and it's very important we have the help of a journalist to do this. So I repeat, I stress this, very important, and they help us a lot to deliver our message. But there are two, how to say, difficulties, or I wouldn't say problems, but they're not only part of the culture of the media, but I think it's part of our society. Again, I don't know the Canadian society. I'm coming from Italy and from Argentina, and we are a kind of superficial in our relationships, and we want things to get done soon, immediate. For example, I got an email from a journalist from Chile. He was writing a piece for El Mercurio, which is the main journal in Chile, and he wanted me to comment on the book of Stephen Hawking, and he gave me a deadline, and I'm sorry, but I cannot answer all the emails, but it was a deadline, because if you answer after that, maybe it's not an important news. After a week, people would forget what was about it. The other point, again, I repeat, I came from Italy last night, is the controversy as a value in itself. The adjective for this is polemic. The noun is controversy, but it comes from the Greek, polemos, war. It seems that always we have to be at war. In Italy, well, soccer is very, very much a passion. So the newspapers, will make a controversy from the game last Sunday until the life of Berlusconi, just to say something. But the problem with this, and sometimes you watch the debates, there are talking points. You don't learn much about, because they repeat from the beginning of the show until the end the same thing without listening to the other one. And that's a very difficult way to learn, because I want to learn. So to me, in this context, the challenge is to promote the dialogue. Even when we know that the dialogue is difficult, takes effort and time. Can we move to the other one? I would like to say about where new atheism. I went to this important source of knowledge, Wikipedia. Sometimes I also use this. And sorry. There is a word for new atheism, and I'm quoting from there. It states that atheism, backed by recent scientific advancement, has reached the point where it is time to take a far less accommodating attitude toward religion, superstition, and religion-based fanaticism that had been extended by moderate atheists, secularists, and some secular scientists. And then I have read some chapters, not all the book, The God Delusion by Dawkins. Dawkins is sympathetic to Robert Peirce's statement, when one person suffers from a delusion, it is called insanity. When many people suffer from a delusion, it is called religion. According to these people, I would be insane. You can judge at the end of my lecture. Maybe that's true. We can move to the... So, according to this situation, science and religion are at war. Can we move, please, to the another? Again, maybe you are very young, you don't know what is Pink Floyd, but searching again with the images in Google, I came to this. This is the cover of one of their CDs, the Division Bell, it's called. It says, again, Wikipedia, much of the album deals with the themes of communication, the idea that talking can solve more of life's problems. Maybe if we talk to each other, we can understand better what is science and what is religion, and maybe avoid a lot of problems. Next slide, please. Well, now I would like to give you some examples where science and faith do matter to each other. These are historical examples. Next, please. I'm a Jesuit. Nobody's perfect. So I'm biased. I'm biased for my lecture. I'm biased because I have selected all the information I want to present you. So you will judge at the end. But I would like to give you some examples, many of them coming from the Jesuit order. This year, we are celebrating the 400th anniversary of Father Matteo Ricci. He was the first European to enter in the court of the Chinese emperor. He was also a mathematician and a cartographer, an astronomer, because at the time these people were know many disciplines and sciences. So this is also a good example of how science and faith do matter to each other. Next, please. This is less known. Again, I'm from Argentina. Again, nobody's perfect. But you may know maybe from the movie The Mission, this part of the South America, in the forest, the Jesuits had there the reductions, these places where they create a kind of new culture, society. And this is less known, but Father Buenaventura was Argentinian. He was also an astronomer. Maybe he was the first Argentinian astronomer. We're talking his life, he was born in 1700 and died in 1750. And in the middle of the forest, there in South America, he had an observatory. You know, for the Catholic Church, there is a tradition of science. Science is important for us. Everything that is human is important for us. And, you know, this is very far from Europe. It was in the 18th century. Still, he communicated with other scientists in Spain, in Germany, even in China. This is another example. Please, next. Another Jesuit astronomer, Giuseppe Boscovich, he was the founder of the Observatory of Brera in Milan. Now it's a state observatory, and again, this is another example of science and faith. Father Secchi, he was one of the main, I would say one of the fathers of the astrophysicists. In the sense we know astrophysics now, he lived in the 19th century, and he was one of the first in classifying the stars, the spectra of the stars. We can learn many things from the spectra of the star. For example, we can learn about the temperature. The rainbows of the stars. We can learn from the spectra, the temperature, the chemical composition. There are many things we can learn from stars, from their spectra. Father Secchi was the first. He studied something like 4,000 stars, and he classified them. Next, please. Of course, it's Georges Lemaître. He wasn't a Jesuit, so he... And as I said before, he was a very good cosmologist by the time, and very serious and recognized by his colleagues. Next. Of course, not everything was fine and great in the Catholic Church. We have Galileo Galilei. He was a mathematician, an astronomer, a physicist, a philosopher, and with a quotation mark, I would say, a biblical scholar. I think he was a biblical scholar because he helped us to read better the Bible and to understand better the Bible. Next, please. So, thanks to Galileo, I'm here. And somehow the history of the Vatican Observatory is related to Galileo's case. I studied my PhD in Padua, which is close to Venice. Galileo was professor there when he, for the first time, he pointed the telescope to Jupiter, its moons, to the to our moon. When he saw the Milky Way in stars, he was in Padua. Next, please. And then I have to answer this question: why the Vatican is interested in astronomy? Next, please. That is the short answer. Next, please. I have to give an answer, otherwise you don't tell this in Rome, but when I used to teach at the University of Arizona, a couple of times my class was on Halloween. So for that day, I showed them this picture to scare them. Now, but who are these people? I already mentioned Angelo Secchi. This is Pope Leo Gregory XIII. He was the one who reformed the calendar. This is Pope Leo XIII. In 1891, he wanted to have an astronomical observatory to show that the Church is not against science, but that the Church promotes good science. And this is Pope Pius XI. With him, the observatory moved from Rome, from the Vatican, to Castel Gandolfo. You see, this is the Papal Palace. I used to live here because we moved last year. You see the two domes? This is another sign of the interest of the Church for science. And the history of the Vatican Observatory is the same history as any other observatory in the world. An enemy for astronomers is light pollution. So we moved in the 80s to Arizona. This is the Department of Astronomy, the Stewart Observatory in Arizona. The observatory was, when there, we have a group of research. And this is the Vatican telescope, the at Mount Graham. Next, please. So, next. And next. I'm going to explain this. What is our mission? We are, I like to say that we are a bridge. Not the only bridge. It's a small bridge between science, astronomers, and the Church. As a bridge, sometimes you are on this side with the astronomers, and sometimes you are on the other side. And it is also the way a priest or a pastor should be a minister. Sometimes on the side of God, sometimes on the side of your people. Next, please. You will forgive me. I'm giving you a little ad, a short ad. We published last year, because it was the International Year of Astronomy, this book, The Heavens Proclaim, Astronomy and the Vatican. and it deals with the history of the observatory, the Bible and astronomy, what we do as research, and some of the addresses of the popes that regard to astronomy. Next, please. And there is a section of question and answers. For example, we have these questions in the book. Is the universe infinite or doesn't have a boundary? Is it true that there is a possibility that the Earth could be destroyed by a gigantic meteorite? If you want to know the answers, buy the book. if you want to ask me those questions after, I can answer them. I also believe in a, now for a moment, for 30 seconds maybe, I'm going to be humble. You know, Jesse, we are not very humble, but I think we are in the at the crossroads, in the crossroads of science and religion. In the sense, we have a religious formation, we believe in God too, and we also scientists. So this is a different perspective, a privileged perspective in this debate, this discussion between science and religion. Next, please. So this is now my starting point for the discussion that we will follow. We're going to start from the reality of the universe and the quest of meaning. I think we can start from science. So, next, please. In our journey, in these few slides, so maybe if you want deeper, we can feel like Dante at the beginning of this wonderful work, The Divine Comedy. Midway upon the journey of our life, I found myself within a forest dark. Maybe sometimes we feel like Dante in our journey. Especially, there are times of darkness in this relationship between science and religion. Next, please. I like to quote Dante for this because I think it is the mission of astronomy. I'm talking now as an astronomer. At the end of this going down to the deepest level of hell, then Dante and Virgilio came out and said, "Then we emerge to see once more the stars. We human beings, we have created different kinds of hells, wars, injustice, well, you can economical and financial crisis, discrimination. You can add to that list whatever you want to put in the list. And astronomy help us to exit from ourselves, to contemplate the universe, and perhaps to understand better where we are and who we are." Next, please. So, humanity has asked this question along its history, from the very beginning, from the Mayas until now. We want to know what is our place in the universe. Next, please. To answer that question, we need telescopes. We are astronomers. And this is Kitt Peake, that especially in the 70s, 60s, was the capital of astronomy of the world. There are about 17 telescopes, 20 telescopes there. And it is in the reservation of the Todohona Odam Native Americans. And the U.S. government has signed an agreement with them in both languages. And in their language, there is no word for astronomer. So they call them the people with the long eyes. So astronomers, not only astronomers, human beings, we have all long eyes. The telescope help us to reach where we cannot reach for ourselves because the objects are too far, are too faint, or because the atmosphere filters their radiation, their light, and we cannot observe them. Next, please. This is the LBT. I forgot to put the slide, but it's the Large Binocular Telescope at Mount Graham. They are our neighbors. There are 2 meters. Each of one is 8.4 meters. This is one of the meters taken up to the top of the mountain. I think this is impressive. Next, please. We want astronomers like kids. We want big toys. And another project in which the University of Arizona is involved is the Giant Magellan Telescope, which has 7 meters, each of them, again, 8.4 meters, which is the equivalent of one telescope with a diameter of 20 meters. We want that because we want to learn about the existence of other planets around stars. We want to understand what is the nature of dark matter and dark energy, what is the process of the formation and evolution of supermassive black holes in the center of galaxies. We want to learn how galaxies form. So these are the basically the main topics in which we are involved and are very exciting for all of us. Next, please. This is a parking lot. You see the size of the telescope and the cars parked there to give you an idea of the size of this telescope. Next, please. The Europeans have this project, the European Extreme Large Telescope. They already exist for the VLT, the Very Large Telescope. They are already working. Four telescopes of 8 meters, each of them. And the next project is this one, the ELT. And this is the Arc of Triumph in Paris. You see, you compare the size of these instruments. Next, please. So what do we know about the universe in one slide? I am ambitious. Basically, we know that the universe is expanding, that it has a beginning according to the Big Bang. The first galaxies and stars form, then the first stars were very massive, they explode very rapidly. The heavier elements like carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, ferrum, that are essential for life, were formed inside the stars. maybe another generation of stars was formed, and then planets like Earth. Basically, you know everything about the universe right here. Next, please. We know that we live in an expanding universe, and we can estimate the age of the universe in 13.7 billion years. This is what we know from science today. Next, please. You understand that it will take a lot to explain these things. We know that the universe is formed by 4% of atoms. You know, atoms like this table, the atoms in our body, the atoms in the stars, in galaxies and planets, and that's only 4% of what we know, the nature of the universe. 23% is made of dark matter and the rest of dark energy. That we don't know what is exactly the nature of dark matter and dark energy. So we know only 4%, just to say, of the whole universe. Next, please. So we live in a universe made more or less of 100 billion galaxies. The last time I checked, maybe now it's about 7 billions of people. There are 7 billion people in the world. And if we divide the number of galaxies by the number of people in the world, each of us has 15 galaxies. You kids, you have 15 galaxies to study. If you become an astronomer, you should know that 15 galaxies are waiting for you to be studied by you. Each of galaxies has about 100 billions of stars. We can go. So, to use an image, I repeat, an image. All the stars in the universe are similar to all the grains of sand in all the beaches of Earth. More or less. Next, please. So, I said that the universe is about 14 billion years old. It's very old, but it's difficult to say how old it is. So if we think in a cosmic calendar, and this moment is the last second, last instant of the 31st December, then the Big Bang happened in this calendar on January the 1st. The Milky Way was formed in February. On September the 3rd, the Earth forms. And in this calendar, again, 1 second ago, for the first time, Galileo pointed his telescope to the sky. So this gives us an idea of how old is the universe. Next, please. What I find amazing is that we can understand the history of the universe from when the universe was 10 to the minus 43 seconds, 0.24 zeros and then 1, from that instant until now, we have a very good understanding of the universe. It's not perfect, but it's quite good. Next. So where we are? We are here. You are. We are in the third planet of the solar system. We are part of the local group of galaxies, about 40 galaxies. Our neighbor, the spiral galaxy that is closer to us, is Andromeda, here. We are part also of the supercluster of galaxies, and this supercluster of galaxies is part of the whole universe. Again, these are very simple things. It would take longer to explain all this. Next, please. So what if we were like this mice here? Okay, next. Well, this is the solar system. In 2006, we learned that Ceres, Pluto, and Eris are dwarf planets. It happened in the meeting of the International Astronomical Union in Prague. I was there for that meeting. It was a very interesting debate. One thing about science. It's not like they have changed in their nature, Pluto, Eris, and Ceres. First, they were planets, and now they became dwarf planets. It's not that. It's our comprehension of these planets that have changed. Now we have more data, more comprehension, and we think that it's better to classify planets in this way. Not everybody would agree with this classification. There are astronomers that they don't agree with this. Next, please. So basically, the solar system formed from a cloud of gas and dust. The first generation of stars was born, then a second generation. In that second or third generation, a star was formed. A disk of dust and gas was formed around the stars, and there the planets were formed. Basically, this is the comprehension of our solar system. Next. So, Martin Rees, which is a famous cosmologist and member of the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, as Stephen Hawking is, said that we are nuclear waste because our atoms once was in the interior of stars. I like Carl Sagan's words, we are stellar dust. It's better, at least for me, it's better to be stellar dust than rather than nuclear waste. Next. So I have one preaching slide, maybe. And it's this. Next. Yes, we are nuclear waste or stellar dust, but we have also divine breath. We are not just, I agree with this. This is a scientific view of what we are. We are atoms, basically, and I agree with that. But I don't agree with reducing the vision of human beings to that. We are more than that. We are more than nuclear waste, we are more than stellar dust. We cannot reduce our lives to nuclear dust. Next, please. So we see plenty of evidence for spinning disks of gas and dust around the stars. This is the star that has been obscured to see the disk of gas and dust. It's an example of other stars that have this disk of dust where maybe planets are forming. Next. And a very exciting topic is the search of exoplanets. We have found something like the last weeks, I think it's about 500 planets orbiting around stars. This is a very exciting topic. Next, please. And with all these discoveries, observational evidences, we have started maybe 50 years ago or so, but in the last years, last 10, 20 years, it has become an important part of science, or a branch of astronomy, if you want, is astrobiology. The lecture this evening is going to be about this. And next, please. So we made the headlines a year ago because we organized at the Pontifical Academy of Sciences a meeting on astrobiology. This is the Washington Post. When E.T. phones the Pope. Well, this is ABC News, Time Magazine, and Time Magazine, what they are studying in the Vatican City. If you want to know more about this, come this evening for the discussion, the panel we want to have about this. Next, please. Well, we... I need some water before. We have learned that we live in a spiral galaxy not very much time ago, about 100 years ago, we're in one of the spiral arms of our galaxy, that, which is this galaxy, spiral galaxy. And let's see what is the structure of the galaxy. This is a design. We cannot go out from our galaxy, take a picture, and then go back. It's impossible. But this gives an idea of what we have learned living inside the galaxy. The distance from the Sun to the center of the galaxy is about 28,000 light years. From one side of the galaxy to the other side of the galaxy, there is a distance of 100,000 light years. Imagine that you send an SMS to your friend in the other side of the galaxy. It will take 100,000 years to arrive. Another 100,000 years if your friend answers you. Okay? The galaxy is also made about a spheroidal component, which is called the bulge, and the halo of the galaxy. We don't see clearly the halo, but there are stars, all stars in the halo of the galaxy. And the thickness of the disk is about 1,000 light years. And these bright white points here are globular clusters that has this perpendicular movement regarding the disk. And let's see the next slide. Globular clusters are these hundreds and thousands of stars. They are very old, and we can learn about the age of the universe, learning about the age of these globular clusters. And this is a different way to compare the age of the universe, because the globular clusters cannot be older than the universe. So they provide us also information about the age of the universe. Next, please. Because I study galaxies, I want to show you very nice pictures of galaxies. This is an elliptical galaxy. It's like American football or a rugby, you play rugby ball. This is a spiral galaxy. It's like a fried egg. I'm hungry now. And you have also irregular galaxies that they don't have a special shape. Hubble, this famous astronomer, studied them and classified them according to the morphology, the shape. This is a beautiful picture of two galaxies merging. Next, please. Because galaxies come also in pairs and they can interact. This is a cluster of galaxies. There can be 1,000 galaxies in a cluster. In the middle, you see in the center an elliptical galaxy, a giant elliptical, which stay in the middle. And astronomers talked about cannibalism. It's not true, of course, because they eat the other small galaxies that are around. Next, please. And the Hubble Deep Field. I would like to say a word about this. There is a deepest observations, but this was the first time we observed, the Hubble Space Telescope observed a very small piece of the universe. Do you know the moon, the full moon? If you divide the full moon in 30 parts and you take only one piece and you observe that piece in the universe, this is what we find. May I come here because for the moment... There it is. We find, so next please, many galaxies. In yellow, you see the area where this corresponds to the field of view of the camera of the telescope. This is an image taken from the Earth, and there are many, very few stars, maybe three or four there. So this is what Hubble found in 1996. Hundreds of galaxies. In that very small piece of the universe. Next, please. I like to quote Isaac Newton. I see, when we see that image of the Hubble Deep Field, I see myself as a child playing on the seaside and sometimes having fun, discovering a small rock or a shell that is more beautiful than normal, while in front of me the huge ocean of the truth extends and explores. This is beautiful and it reflects or explains who astronomers are. We are like children playing with the galaxies, with the stars. And this is beautiful. So remember, if you want to become an astronomer, that you are going to have a lot of fun. Next. So, now we are moving to the philosophical or theological part of the talk. So this is a question that the humanity has asked for many centuries. Why is there a universe with billions of galaxies rather than nothing? Next. And I'm talking now about the quest of our meaning. Why is there a universe with 100 billions of galaxies rather than nothing? Is the question that humanity has raised from centuries. It's a problem of ultimate origin of the world and humanity, of the world and humanity. It's the origin of world and humanity. And I think it is an unavoidable question. Is there an ultimate meaning of the universe? Is there a purpose? Do we live in a hostile universe or in a friendly one? Kindness, a scientific theory, provides significance to the human existence or to our fundamental decisions. Next, please. What I understand in the context of this discussion, faith, theology, and religion, of course, they are incomplete. As faith, I understand here the integral answer of the man or woman or of the whole community to God that reveals himself as a savior. As theology, I understand the critical understanding, and it's in blue because it's important, this word, a critical understanding of the contents of the faith in order that the life of the believer be full of significance. In this sense, theologians are not a kind of scholars. Every Christian should be a theologian. Each of us should reflect upon this important question, how to find significance to our lives. And religion expresses the relation between human being and the sacred. It is a conscious and effective acknowledgement of the dependence on an absolute reality, the sacred, the divine. Again, this is, of course, incomplete. Next. Science. Again, this is incomplete. Seeks explanation that relies solely on natural causes, progresses through the creation and testing of models of nature. Models must take testable predictions. The Big Bang theory or model was so successful, it is so successful, because it was able to make predictions, and these predictions were tested. And in this context, I'm only referring to astrophysics or cosmology. Of course, there are other natural sciences. Next, please. I'm here following Arthur Peacock. The scientists respond with wonder and intellectual excitement to the search of the ultimate nature of the universe, and at the same time, with awareness at the incompleteness of our real understanding of the cosmos. We don't know everything about the cosmos. Science and theology are characterized by the search of intelligibility. This is important. We think that we can understand the universe. Next, please. There are two sorts of why questions. Why do we live in this galaxy rather than in an elliptical one? Science provides an answer by depicting the realities of the natural world in a metaphorical language, galaxy formation theory. If you have questions about this, please ask Dr. Cummings about that. He knows a lot. Don't ask me. Why is there a universe with billions of galaxies at all? Why galaxies are so beautiful? Their religious and philosophical quest presses such wide questions. Next. So there are, I would say, two kinds of search in our relation to the world: the search of intelligibility, the best explanation, and the search for meaning in human existence, in general and in particular. What I mean, if you think of yourself in your own life, you have a sense on your whole life, but also you have to find, you want to find, I mean, I try to do it. Try to find a sense, a meaning for each action or decision, important decision, of course, that you want to make. I believe that there is a sense for the whole humanity also, and a sense for each of us, a meaning for each of us. So in that sense, in general, in particular. Next, please. What is the explanation and the meaning of the universe that generates from within itself entities who seek truth, create beauty, strive for goodness, have moral purposes, and create community? What is the explanation and meaning of a cosmos in which these intelligent beings seem to undergo pain, suffering, and death? In front of this question for meaning, one can say the quest for meaning is meaningless, or the source of meaning could be transcendent or immanent. Next. If you think that you have a source of meaning which is immanent, for example, I'm here reducing things. Life is more complicated. Matter is eternal. My objection to that is that we have a strong evidence that the universe evolves and there was a beginning. Our existence is chanceful, purposeless. I prefer to think that my life, my existence, has a purpose. Next. If you are Christian, for us, God has the power of making our intelligibility, beauty, and righteousness. May be said to explain the universe in that he gives in the sense that he gives it meaning and intelligibility, provides purpose and significance, and so sets all things within an overall context. In other words, if you are a scientist, somehow God is the best model that fits the existential data. Next. The best model is not enough, I think, to say that God is the best model that explains my existence. The faith of the Church derives from experience of God, not from a model that fits the existential data. There is a religious experience in the foundation of the Church. The experiences and encounters with God in the Bible are paradigm for all Christian believers. In the experience of Moses, Abraham, and other people in the Bible reflect our own experience of God. In that experience, in the Bible, God is experienced first as a savior, and then in a second moment, you understand that this God that forgives you, that saves you, is also the creator of the whole universe that gives explanation and meaning. Next, please. More questions. I don't have answers for this. Now I'm honest. Is there any relation between the search of the scientific explanation of the universe and the search for a source of existential meaning? What is the impact of the scientific research on culture and religion? What is the impact of my philosophical and religious beliefs on my research, on my professional relations? I want to make a point here. Science also consists of institutional and human relations. It's not pure objectivity. It's made by human beings. Some time ago, I was in Argentina, and I found the title of this book in Spanish, and caught my attention. It's a book for burned out priests, rabbis, and ministers. Caught my, of course, I wasn't burned at the time, now maybe it's different, but it caught my attention. So there is a story in that book that is has this title, The First Book of Dichotomies and the Second Book of Symbiosis. And I thought that could be a good way to talk about the relation between science and faith. Dichotomy, I went to the dictionary, is a division or the process of dividing especially mutually exclusive or contradictory groups. Symbiosis, state of living together, the intimate living together of two dissimilar organisms in a mutually beneficial relationship. Is there other ways of relating science and religion? So I think that science and faith do matter to each other. I'm going to say why, I hope. If we adopt this model for the relation between science and faith, the symbiosis model, the critical thought, is the kind of thought that we have in science and theology, can help us to purify our image of God, our faith from irrational elements. I believe that our faith is rational, but there may be irrational elements in our faith. Who kills in the name of God, we cannot say that that is rational. On the other side also, there are ethical values of Christianity that can help us to purify science, or better, scientists and the scientific institution, not science itself, from dehumanizing elements. Next, please. There are other ways, John Polkinghorne lists this kind of ways of relating between relations between science and faith: conflict, independence, dialogue, integration, consonance, and assimilation. I'm not going to discuss all of them, but I would like to stress dialogue. I think it's very important, even when it takes time and effort. I think to dialogue is very important. Next. And to conclude now, I like very much this address of the Pope to the Catholic schools. The Pope was talking to kids and teachers from Catholic schools. But I think this is true for other Christian schools, and even it could be important for other people that even cannot believe in God. In your Catholic schools, says the Pope, there is always a big picture. I like this expression in English, to have a big picture, over and above the individual subject you study. As you move higher up the school, you have to make choices regarding the subject you study. You begin to specialize with a view to what you are going to do later on in life. This is right and proper, but always remember that every subject you study is a part of a bigger picture. Never allow yourselves to become narrow. I think this is very important. We cannot allow ourselves to become narrow. The world needs good scientists, but a scientific outlook becomes dangerously narrow if it ignores the religious or ethical dimension of life. Just as religion becomes narrow if it rejects the legitimate contribution of science to our understanding of the world. I think this is a good way to put how science and faith do matter to each other. Next, please. I would like to conclude with this galaxy is a result of a merger. This is a big picture, a very nice picture. I took 2 or 3 days ago from the Astronomy Picture of the Day. This is a very nice website with very beautiful images, with a good explanation of the images. So I would like to conclude with this big picture of the universe and hoping that it will help us to understand better science and faith. Thank you.
I would invite you to comment or query, to raise things you would like to think about with Father Funes. And at the end of this part, I would really like to ask Professor Cummins if he would give us a few sort of summative remarks in response as well. But and for you who are young, I want to say that I give you, the speaking of the Pope, the preferential option. So I would love to have you raise things and speak to things. So think about it, and if you just raise your hand in the usual way, and you'll be more than welcome. So who would like to kick off? Please.
As your token, David, I will ask the first question.
My token. He's revealed himself. It's not often, you know, that Jesuits come out of the closet. I shouldn't say that, should I? I keep. Please.
Father, in Stephen Hawking's latest book, which you referred to, and I understand you haven't read it, but if I understand one of the things he says there, he states that there is no reason which would rule out the universe having created itself. Does that bring into conflict in your idea, faith and science?
I want to comment your question because I have received similar questions, not referring to the book exactly, because I haven't read the book and I don't want to be unfair. But my understanding of what Hawking says, he understands, well, Hawking is not saying nothing really new. In the 18th century, if I'm not wrong, Laplace, who was a famous French scientist, was explaining to Napoleon, you say in English, his model of the solar system, and Napoleon asked him, what role does God play in your model? And Laplace's answer was, it's a hypothesis that I don't need. Basically is what Hawking is saying. The problem is how Hawking sees God, and of course I don't need that kind of God for my faith and also for explaining the universe. What is amazing is that we can understand the universe from when it started, and we know from when the universe was 10 to the minus 43 seconds old until now. But we don't have, as far as I know, a physics laws or theories that can allow to understand what happened first. Maybe in the future we are going to be able to understand the universe even before time equal to zero. I don't know right now the answer. But what we know from faith is from a different level of reality. When we say that God created from nothing, we are not saying that everything started from the Big Bang or there was nothing before the Big Bang. What we are saying is that our existence, the existence of the universe, depends on God. This is difficult to explain, but if God, for, let's play a little bit, said for a moment, I don't want to sustain the universe, everything would collapse, but not from the physical point of view. It's a metaphysical point of view. The message of Genesis is a religious message. It's not an explanation of science. And again, our comprehension of faith, of the beginning of everything, of beginning of our understanding and meaning of the universe and our own lives, it's a religious knowledge. It's not the scientific knowledge. So I'm able to, I would like to change my mind from the scientific point of view if we have more information from the science, but until now we don't. As far as I know, I will respond that way.
Do you want to push forward on that?
Well, what you're saying then is that if we are able to push back farther to the origin of the universe, as I understand the problem now is that farther, when we get back to that early point, quantum mechanics and macro laws just don't work anymore at that point. So even if we do find some physical explanation that takes us back to zero or before zero, that doesn't change the metaphysical position I think you're taking, which is that the universe, however it began, is contingent, and God is absolute.
Exactly.
Would that be fair to say?
Yes.
Please.
I can understand how that would be your perspective. I just want to comment on that and then make a suggestion. It seems to me that we couldn't comprehend it. We couldn't come to it if there wasn't a coherence of being. And it's the truth of it that we hear in here, the coherence, the way it all makes sense, right? That's the place where we see God. And if there was no coherence, whether or not the physicality exists, it's incomprehensible. How would consciousness ever evolve to understand if there was no coherence and truth to be understood? So, in my mind, that would be the place to look for God. There's no reason to expect to see God in the beginning of the universe. It's a physical history. And the point I would like to make has to do with life on other planets. The question arises, if there is life on other planets, how come they've never contacted us? And I'm wondering if anyone has ever made the response about the lost sheep, the parable of the lost sheep. If individual consciousness is not a natural evolution, we wouldn't expect to see radio transmission.
I see. It's not that I don't want to answer your question, but I don't know if there is a conflict of interest with the lecture this evening, because I can answer that question.
I'm going to be able to make it.
Okay, no. My answer,
yeah,
may,
sure,
no problem.
Sure.
One way to, well, is the Fermi's paradox. If they exist there, why we haven't contacted them, or we haven't not contacted by them? Well, there are different ways to answer that question. Maybe because one thing for me is an important factor is distances in the universe. It's very difficult to travel, and Neil Cummings is an expert on this. It's very difficult to travel in space. Just to give you an idea, if you think the Sun and Alpha Centaurus, which is the closest star to us, if we put them at the scale of a grapefruit, in the map of North America, one star would be in Washington, D.C., and the other one would be in San Francisco. It's very difficult to travel in space. Then we have to assume that life evolved, and if it evolved like we know on Earth, there are big if. Then we're in the hypothesis of finding intelligent life. Just to put in a few words, it's already difficult to find intelligent life on Earth. We can imagine to find intelligent life. Sorry.
Professor Cummings, do you want to speak to this question a little bit? Is that okay?
Yeah, yes, of course. No, I'm concluding just now, and you can add for the science part because you are the expert on this. From the theological point of view, I made the example of the lost sheep. I didn't make it. It was one of the fathers of the church that we can imagine us as the lost sheep, and that God was sent his son to the lost sheep to save us. But there are maybe other 99 that don't need from redemption. But it's more complicated than that. But
which church father was that?
I don't know. I don't recall the.
Would you like to respond to the question a little bit?
Yes, let me just make sure that I'm responding to the question. The question is, why haven't we heard from them yet?
Specifically, why don't we see any radio transmissions from less limited to the galaxy? I mean, we're looking at 100,000 light years.
Very good. And from my perspective, that's why haven't we detected or heard from them, even if they weren't intending to send us information. It turns out, well, let me just give you one of many possible issues. 50 years ago, when people started...
Can everybody hear?
Yes. Yeah, people tell me I have a big mouth. 50 years ago, when people started scientifically exploring the possibility of detecting the existence of other civilizations through electromagnetic radiation, radio waves, basically. It was a time in Earth's technological existence where we were just sending out all kinds of signals, television and radio. We were using the transmitters that just sort of sent information out in every which direction. 50 years later, or so now, we are communicating much, much more than the people 50 years ago. But we're doing it in a way where we focus that energy. We send it on the internet. We send it through optical cables. It's not just broadcast everywhere. And that's only in, well, we first started doing radio technology 120 years ago. In the last one century, we've gone from being very wasteful of energy, which would help us see that, by the way, to being much more conservative with our use of that same energy. So if we were to go off the Earth today and turn around and look back at the energy we're sending into space to say, hi, we're out there, not just to say, hi, we're out there, but so the people out there could say, hey, they are there, we are there, we would see much, much less of it than we would have 100 years ago.
Except for the clearly articulated hi, we're here.
If we are trying to communicate with them, then indeed, and we do that sometimes.
Yes, yeah.
You know, every once in a while, they'll take a radio telescope and make it a radio transmitter, beam signal out into space. But then comes the issue of how far away they are. And just one of the numbers to think about is that if one does some estimates as how close the nearest civilization probably is, whatever probably means, it's something like 1,500 light years. Okay, so as Father Kunis was saying, it would take 1,500 years for our signals to get to them, 1,500 years for their signals to get back to us. So if the closest civilization is 1,500 light years away, nobody out there knows we're here from the signals sent only 100 years ago. And if they miss those signals, that 100-year interval of our wasting energy in space, and if they are not in the beam of the signals we're sending to say, hi, we're out there, chances are very small they'll know we're here at all. So I would turn that around and say the same thing applies coming here.
Great. Thanks so much. Please.
Just commenting and questioning, with the apparitions in Medjugorje, I know they're not approved by the church, but just working off of this, one of the children asked so many years ago, one of their first questions is there life on other planets? Does the Vatican have any comments to those apparitions right now?
Thank you.
Can you repeat the question out loud?
Yes. If I understood well, your question is if the Vatican or the Church has a particular position regarding the life in the universe. Is that the question?
Regarding apparitions in Medjugorje.
Regarding?
The apparitions in Medjugorje.
The apparitions in Medjugorje.
Yeah. Asked this question. Yeah.
And it is related to the apparition in Medjugorje. For those of that you're not Catholic or you're not familiar, in other places, Medjugorje is one of places where some people believe that Our Lady appeared there, and there is a lot of people going there because it is a pilgrimage site, exactly. While all these things has not been approved officially by the Church, one thing to say. and commenting on you, it's not really, I don't see any relation. One thing I would like to say and to stress is that there is no Catholic position on everything. I mean, it's not that the Pope has to...
only in the mind of its critics.
I know that I think hockey is very popular in Canada, I guess. It's not that the Pope has to say who is going to be the winner for the hockey season. Well, I'm kidding, but it's important to understand that, of course, there are issues that the Catholic Church has to pronounce and explain, but there is no official position on this from the Catholic Church. And my comment, I got a similar question from a journalist from the Vatican newspaper. And while then journalists, people were saying, now the Vatican is in favor or approving alien life or something like that. And I just was answering a question of a journalist as I'm answering your question. I am the director of the Vatican Observatory, which is something like the astrologer in chief of the Pope. No, it's not. It's not true. I mean, for the kids, the Pope doesn't believe in a horoscope, neither I. So there is no official position, even when I am in an official position. There is no official position. What I would say is it depends on what science tell us. And I got a question from a journalist. If you learn that there is life in the universe, who would be the first person to tell this? The Pope? And well, I said, somebody said to me, you should have an answer to your mother, but I would check first with my colleagues to see if this discovery makes sense or not. Once we're sure that makes sense from the scientific point of view, then we can think about all the philosophical and theological implications that it will have. But first, I would say, for this question on life in the universe, we need to wait for what science has to tell us. There is no official position of the Church.
You want to go further with that? Is that good? Just a moment, please.
I was just thinking about communications. It's sort of based on the assumption that we all communicate in a way or that other culture or whatever life communicates in the way that we do.
Just a touch louder.
We could just be noise to them. They may not operate in radio frequencies or whatnot. So as a energies of noise being out there for centuries and centuries, it just might, they might be operating hieroglyphically for all we know, and not necessarily in what we would consider early phases of communication. So it may actually exist, but not in a platform that we can actually define or see. That's like assuming I can go to Argentina and I'm speaking, but I may not necessarily exist.
Or the way in which I treat some of my neighbors. They are noise.
Sure.
Let me just say one thing about your very interesting question. No matter what kind of communication they are getting from us, as far as we... No, science. As far as science knows, it has to be what we call electromagnetic. It has to be some kind of radio waves, infrared, visible light, X-ray, ultraviolet, or gamma rays. Because that's the only way that we in science know that information can be transmitted from one place to another, with a couple of small caveats, which don't matter for the following reason. All electromagnetic radiation and all of the other fine points, gravitational radiation is what I have in mind, they all travel at the speed of light. Regardless of anything else, they all travel at the same speed, 300,000 kilometers per second. And if they out there are looking at us, they indeed may not be detecting radio waves from us now or ever. It is possible that they may detect the heat given off by our growing crops, for example. That's not out of the question. But the fact is that given the distance, the astronomical distances involved, the communication rate is restricted to that the science knows. Not science fiction, of course we can travel at warp speed, but that the science knows to 300,000 kilometers per second, that's thousands of years between us and who else might be out there. I don't know if that addresses
the point is, if I may... Just a moment.
Just a moment. Were you going to respond?
Well, it's just like the wavelengths of light and stuff, of UV radiation for us is detrimental outside of a certain range. Mm-hmm. So if we're sending, how do we know that's not toxic to whoever we're sending out? Mm-hmm. It's normal for us, it may not...
We don't know.
It may not even impact that society when they get it. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yes, I do. And let me just say that at the time factor is one thing, but the closest distance is to us from here to any possible civilization, the amount of energy that they would possibly receive from us of any kind, dangerous or otherwise, is so low that it would take massive technology on their part to even detect it, much less to have it affect them.
And just the point about the lost sheep parable, I think, is the same point you're making now. There's no reason to think that every instance of the evolution of life would utilize electromagnetic radiation.
Well, we're just incredibly adaptive organisms, I think, here. So that's not to say we're seeing our own image elsewhere. I mean, life presents itself.
If I make a comment about this communication problem, since we are in a Star Trek room, until we don't invent a universal translator, it would be difficult. But I have heard some talks, I think from Chris Hampi, a provocative talk that, for example, it could be the case also. I don't know in the future, but biologists who study the communication of, monkeys or dolphins, could be also that kind of problem of communication that we... But this is very, very... improbable, I would say, in case we find, as you said, going to Argentina and don't understand it, but we don't know.
Please.
See, if we are the state of Star Trek, we can communicate with beings. So how would we explain God to them, even if they have their own religion?
Just to make things easier. A paradigm to understand what would be our encounter with our other civilizations, it could be similar. It's my way of thinking to what happened when Europeans came to America. It wasn't clear, even for the Catholic Church and for some theologians, that native from America were human beings like us. And many of their rights were not recognized until later, much later. So how we could explain God to them as I would say that, taking the example of the Jesuits, first thing you have to do to be a good missionary is to learn the language and to understand people and understand them, what are the big questions they have, listen to them. After you have done that, understand that, listen to them and try to learn from them, because maybe we could also learn from them about God. So this is what I would say, as the missionary, the Jesuits, for example, did. And there is a novel, Sparrow, I think it's called.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't read it, but one of the characters of the novel is about a space travel or colonization of new worlds, and there is a Jesuit even there, so read the novel.
Jesuits are everywhere.
Please.
On a practical base, we're in a place of learning here, and at the end when you were showing the quote, Father, on school systems, and sort of a greater meaning that we need good science and we need good humanists. I'm wondering if you have seen examples around the world where interdisciplinary actually helps bridge those areas, because one of the concerns I see is as we become more specialists in every walk of life, we do by definition become a little bit more narrow, not necessarily in our hearts, but the language goes a mile deep and not a mile wide. So are there, with this mixed group, examples where you've seen successful bridging of science and humanism, or God and science, through travels and talks that we might see applied here in our community?
Yes, I'm glad I completely agree with your comment. And I didn't know that the kids were going to be here, so I put the slide, even not knowing that they're going to be here, but because I think it's important that I don't like to become narrow in my views. So I think that's important. What you say is very true. Sometimes I go to meetings, science meetings in both galaxies, and if I'm not working exactly in the field of the speaker, I don't understand what he or she is saying. So it is very difficult to be a good researcher in your area, but at the same time keep an eye on everything else. Of course, we are not God, that we have to know about everything, but at least I think it's good to develop in us this attitude to be open to other things, other parts of reality, and knowing that you never end of learning. You always have to learn. It is a challenge, and it is difficult, but I think it's worthwhile to try.
I just wonder if there was a model that you've seen.
Model. Okay. I understand now.
Interdisciplinary.
Yeah. Yes.
So
yes.
I guess Chester Ronnie.
The model I have in mind is the Pontifical Academy, because it's a Catholic Church there, but it's the one I know. Scientists from different areas come and talk to each other. For example, Stephen Hawking is a member, but there are also Francis Collins, for example, who did a lot of research on the human genome, is one of the fathers of this. My experience, I learned there also a lot. I'm a member not because I'm a good scientist, but because I have the job of the Vatican Observatory, not because of my quality as a researcher, I have to be honest, and thrilled to be there and listen to these people. This is a way, and they discuss. And I mean, we have to make the effort to talk and to speak to people in a language that the other can understand me. This is the first way to do it. And for example, one of the suggestions of the meeting of the astrobiologist week was to encourage the study of astrobiology, which is a very difficult discipline, because you have biologists, you have astronomers, you have physicists. For example, the suggestion was that a marine biologist go to an observatory and work with the astronomer, or an astronomer go on a ship and work with the marine biologist. You have to put in this place of the other person. This is one experience. And the other experience is at the University of Arizona, one of the Jesuits there, Father Steger, is involved in it's called the St. Albert Forum. Is at the Newman Center of the university, and every 2 weeks they have seminars about science and religion, and this is also a place where people can interact. I don't have any other model or answer to give to this.
Thank you. One last one, and we'll. I think you were first here.
I was just wondering, and I know this could be a very large question, but I was just wondering if you had any examples of how the work in science, and obviously particularly astronomy since that's your focus, has influenced theology or ideas about God.
how has the work in science and particularly astronomy influenced theology and the thinking about the divine?
It's a good question, and it's difficult to answer. I would go to Galileo, because this is an example when scientific result challenged the philosophical and theological thinking of the time. The passage, the concrete text of the Bible was when Joshua, I think you say in English, stopped the sun. How do you explain that if the earth is moving around the sun? I'm not going to enter all the discussion, but we know that Galileo was right on the interpretation of the Bible. So I think this is a good example, a data or a scientific result challenge us to understand better how we read the Bible. This could be an example of how science can help us to improve our religious knowledge or religious interpretation of life.
And of course, Professor Neil Cummins has named one of his sons Joshua. So I guess there's where the link is. May I ask you just to give us, you want to make a few final remarks?
Let me just address your question as to places or situations where different peoples of different groups, different areas, can work together effectively. Is that a reasonable statement?
Yes, in this nugget, but here we're sitting with, you know, all these bright minds of young people. If there's something that we can use this dialogue ahead one more step.
Well,
now, yes.
Let me propose two things to do in an environment to bring people together. So you choose to bring a bunch of young people together, for example. Okay? And I do this in another context every year. So and I know it works. Although I'm not prepared to say where or when. But anyways, if you do two things with a group of people of any, you know, whether they're, you know, young people or, you know, highly educated people from other areas, doesn't matter. If you tell them to leave their egos at the door and treat everyone in the room or in the meeting as a long-lost cousin, you will get an interaction between them unlike any that you get under other conditions. So just it's a meta answer to your question, I realize. But those two things are really powerful. First of all, if you don't, people can't communicate as effectively. And if you do, if you leave your ego at the door and you treat everyone as a family, you can get an amazing amount of communication.
May I say,
please.
I now understand your question, and I'm sorry about that. At the level of the school, it's very difficult, first of all. I would say that could be a big step forward. For example, I'm talking a confessional school or a Catholic school, would be nice and to be encouraged. For example, if the teacher of religion or philosophy would know what the teacher of science is teaching, at least. Because, for example, could be a good way, if you are teaching creation in your religious class, could be nice to tell the kids, as you are learning in the science course about the Big Bang or the solar system, just this kind of thing help. I'm not talking about confusing the classes, because in the science class you have to teach science, and in the religion class you teach religion. But if at least the faculty is aware there is a communication between the faculty, there could be references to the kids and to help them to understand what they are learning.
So thank you so much.